The Institute for Transportation and Development Policy defines TOD, or transit-oriented development, as, quote, a means of integrating urban places designed to bring people, activities, buildings, and public space together with easy walking and cycling connection between them and near excellent transit service to the rest of the city. It means inclusive access for all to local and citywide opportunities and resources by the most efficient and healthful combination of mobility modes, at the lowest financial and environmental cost, and with the highest resilience to disruptive events. I know what you're thinking. It's a lot of words, but it doesn't really say anything. We have a lot of TOD projects underway here in the Seattle metro area as Sound Transit is expanding the light rail system to suburban areas. There are ample development projects underway. However, these developments, like most transit-oriented development in the U.S., they will still largely be auto-centric and planned in a manner that prioritizes cars over people, livability, and quality of life. Today on the Livable Low Carbon City podcast, we're going to be talking about how to un-f**k TOD. Welcome to the Livable Low Carbon City podcast, the show about the interconnectedness of low-carbon living, decarbonized buildings, and quality of life. I am your host, Michael Eliason, architect and founder of Large Lab. So, what are some of my critiques of transit-oriented development in the U.S.? Well, I would say the biggest is there really is no urban structure to the way that most of these are planned. The second is there's very little open space. If there is open space, it is largely auto-centric, and so the open space is generally surrounded on three or sometimes even four sides by streets that will see a high volume of traffic. Another aspect is that these tend to be very auto-dominated, auto-centric developments, even though it is, quote, transit-oriented development. There'll be a number of parking garages. TOD should be an opportunity to bring ample social housing, affordable housing, and other forms of non-market housing to places that have frequent transit. But the reality is the market tends to drive development rather than the development driving opportunities. So you get thick buildings, they have a high floor area ratio, they're all largely double-loaded corridors, and most of the units inside these buildings will be studios and one bedrooms. There's not an ample mix of housing, there's few opportunities for family-sized housing. Generally, there are no opportunities for co-housing, co-ops, Baugruppen, and other forms of non-market housing like you would see in transit-oriented development in some other countries. And there's also not a huge mix of social housing as well. So transit-oriented development offers a number of benefits. It can improve public health outcomes. It can strengthen the local economy. It creates the opportunity for sustainable neighborhoods, car-free, car-light living. But the way we do urban planning in the U.S., we leave a lot on the table and we aren't creating the kinds of places where people can live long term. Let's talk a little bit about my critique of transit-oriented development in the U.S. We can start with the aesthetic critique. It all kind of looks the same. And TOD in one city can look almost verbatim like TOD in another. Part of this has to do with the way development is just done in the U.S. Our building codes result in big, banal buildings. Cities will bring in planning overlays to make big buildings look smaller. I hate to bring it all back to the double-loaded corridor, but double-loaded corridor results in some of the most banal buildings I've ever seen. You know, from the aesthetic standpoint, it's pretty obvious that transit-oriented development leaves a lot to be desired. They're not generally very attractive buildings. The quality of public space tends to be pretty middling as well. There generally aren't great public spaces. There's not a lot of open space. Many transit-oriented developments don't have much green space. If they do incorporate green space, it's generally next to cars, traffic, noise. The economics of development in the U.S. and the building code, you know, really also tend to drive these buildings to be studios or one-bedroom units. From the standpoint of mix of units and housing, there doesn't really tend to be a large diversity in housing types, housing units. Again, primarily, there'll be rentals. The opportunity for ownership will be severely limited, and there's certainly little opportunity for affordable home ownership. There's not a lot of diversity in unit sizes. Typically, these will just be flats, and some of the smaller ones, maybe townhouses, on the outskirts of the development. But the flats will tend to be one-bedroom studio, not a lot of family-sized options. Units that are sized for families will not necessarily be affordable. And the layout of the units tends to prioritize flexibility in terms of tenants. And so there'll be as many bathrooms generally as there are bedrooms. And so it really becomes a place for roommates to share a family-sized apartment than having apartments that are geared specifically for families. Generally, there's very little opportunity for multi-generational housing. Student housing tends to be fairly rare. There's not a lot of diversity in the unit types either, right? There's generally flats. There are no maisonettes. There are no cluster apartments. Even the number of condos tends to be fairly restricted. And so because of this, you don't have a good economic and social mix of residents. You've got primarily people who can afford high rents and new buildings. When it comes to affordable housing for these districts, it normally feels like an afterthought. Perhaps there's a parcel or two dedicated to affordable housing, or perhaps there's a weak and mostly ineffective inclusionary zoning policy that gets a little bit of affordable housing in a mostly market rate building. There aren't a lot of opportunities for more non-market forms of housing, co-housing, Baugruppen, community land trusts, cooperatives, and things of that nature. And a lot of this is because we don't plan for these kind of inclusive developments from the outset. It's largely driven by market dictating outcomes because there isn't an emphasis on more affordable housing, more family-friendly housing. There aren't a lot of opportunities to integrate daycare and schools into the district. And so these spaces tend to be not so friendly towards children either. On the open space side, there's a lot to critique. Most transit-oriented development in the U.S. doesn't have a lot of open space. They certainly don't have a lot of green space. Generally, when there is green space, it's adjacent to streets, traffic, noise, air pollution. You know, we don't use buildings to block sound. And so they aren't the most attractive places to be in terms of acoustics. We're not really good at incorporating affordable workspaces, work lofts, affordable artist ateliers, affordable co-working spaces, small little innovative maker spaces into these projects. And we're not really good at integrating a lot of social services or community amenities, social amenities into these kinds of developments either. And so it's not really an opportunity to be looking at the broader neighborhood and elevating it. You know, so few of these buildings are designed as passive house. Almost none are mass timber. They are generally buildings that have a really high amount of embodied carbon. They're not super climate adaptive. You know, so the way that we're planning and developing these districts, it's not forward-looking, it's not innovative, it's not climate adaptive. And so why is this important? Well, we are wasting the opportunity to turn every one of these eco-districts into very walkable, livable, family-friendly neighborhoods with community services, local services, access to good jobs, access to affordable housing, access to open space, in a manner that is accessible to a broader array of residents. And so this means that we're not maximizing our investments in transit to be more equitable. It means we're not maximizing our investments in transit to be more climate adaptive. We're not leveraging what we could to make these places that have a very high quality of life, that are very livable, where someone could live within the same neighborhood effectively for the rest of their lives, but in different housing types. We're really closing the door on transit-oriented development as a means of mitigating climate change, making more livable places, making more affordable housing, making places that have a good economic and social mix of residents and workers and things of that nature. These units also tend to have very little private outdoor space. There are generally not functional semi-enclosed or enclosed courtyards for these buildings. Balconies, loggia, and other forms of direct private outdoor living are non-existent. The mix of uses is generally pretty sterile as well. It's rare that schools and even daycare are necessarily integrated into these, as well as other social services. And so what you get are these sterile, banal developments that are not economically and socially mixed. They don't have a wide mix of residents. They're not incredibly family friendly. They're not affordable. And so what are some solutions that we could be doing to, quote, unf**k TOD? Recent trends in European transit-oriented development eco-districts that are largely missing from the U.S. The first component is really, there are two things. One is urban planning in Europe undergoes typically a competition process. And I think that this is a smart way of planning for a couple of reasons. One, what you see is what you get. The public has a better understanding of what's going to happen through this process. These also get judged by professionals, city leaders who understand urban concepts, who understand urban morphology, who understand how best to integrate transportation, housing, jobs, and do so in a way that does allow for livable environments with a high quality of life, ample amounts of open space, and things of this nature. There's also an opportunity through the competition process of inviting the public in and getting their feedback, incorporating that feedback, and making projects better. In the U.S., we don't really have this process. So what are a couple of models that we can talk about that get at some of the better ways I think that we should be developing? But if we look at how European transit-oriented development tends to be planned, there's a lot more intentionality. There's a lot more focus on livability, on quality of life, on affordability, a good social and economic mix of residents as well as jobs. And so let's talk about a couple of different TOD projects that just I'm completely enamored with and have been talking about for a long time. So let's take Vienna's Sonnenwendviertel district as a contrast. Let's set the scene. This is a brownfield redevelopment that is centered on a tram line sandwiched between an existing historic district from the 1800s and the approach to Vienna's main train station. The development itself is an 84-acre parcel, and running through the middle is 17-acre Helmut Zilk Park. This is a massive green space accessible not just for the residents who live there, but for residents in the adjoining neighborhoods. And in the planning of Sonnenwendviertel, there are several daycare facilities integrated into the perimeter blocks. So imagine not having to walk far to take your kids to daycare, hopping on a tram or a light rail and going directly into work. It also integrates a large educational campus with primary and middle schools. The development had a very strong mobility concept. And so one of the things that they did was place elevated car parking structures along the tracks that approach the train station. This does a couple of things. One, it gets the cars outside of the core of the development. Two, the parking structures effectively act as a noise barrier, keeping the noise levels within the district and especially within the park relatively low. Third, they're elevated structures. If the structures are smartly planned, then in the future, as car usage decreases, these could be converted over to other uses, whether it's affordable job spaces, industrial worker spaces, maker spaces, or even housing. In total, there are around 5,500 apartments for 13,000 people. This is important because it lets you know that a number of these units are larger family-friendly units. There's space for 20,000 jobs, which means that we have offices integrated into it. There are spaces for workshops, artist ateliers, galleries. Residential buildings have commercial spaces at the ground floor. There are affordable co-working spaces, community kitchens, community gardens. There are bike workshops, cafes, grocery stores. All of this is integrated into the community. There are also seminar rooms and community rooms that are accessible to the larger district. There's temporary housing for workers, for refugees. There are social and cultural venues as well. And because it's built up next to an existing district, there's the possibility for intermixing within adjacent districts. The way that we do development in the U.S., we tend to sandwich transit-oriented development along arterials, along highways. And so there's very little opportunity to integrate that development into adjoining neighborhoods or districts. They're divided by highways. In looking at the urban structure of Sonnenwendviertel, the generally semi-permeable perimeter blocks, this means that each block has a ring of buildings, but the ring is not continuous. There are openings, and this is a number of things around. Generally, there's a hard edge along the street that the development runs along. Again, this keeps the interior courtyard of the semi-permeable perimeter block relatively quiet as well. And then there's several rows of buildings that work to make the park in the center of the development effectively as quiet as it possibly can. The development is a broad mix of housing types and housing affordability. There are Baugruppen and there is market rate housing. There's social housing. Unlike almost any TOD project in the U.S., over 60% of the buildings are devoted to non-market forms of living. What this means is that most of the people who are living in this district will not be wealthy. They will not be in the top 10%. It's not necessarily tech workers. It's the people, their teachers, their construction workers, their firefighters. They're the people who work to make cities run on a daily basis. And this provides the space for them to be able to live in the places that they work and play. So on the mobility side, it's near Vienna's main train station. It has a tram line that runs through it, the D line. There are ample bike paths that stitch together the neighborhood as well and go out into the adjoining districts. But maybe one of the more interesting things about this district is that most of it is not accessible by car. There are streets that cars can go down, but the semi-permeable perimeter blocks, the park, are not accessible by car, and they allow effectively walking around the entire district without having to interact with a car. And this is a concept I think that we should revisit in a future episode. And another aspect of this is there's a massive pedestrian zone running down the spine of the development. And what this is a car-free road with businesses, cafes, housing, restaurants, grocery stores, markets, everything kind of spilling out into this street creates this wonderful dynamic atmosphere where you're not inundated by car noise. You're not inundated by traffic violence. You're not inundated by air pollution. And it's quiet. It's livable. I think that for me personally, it's a kind of place where I could send my kid to go get groceries and not have to worry about them crossing a street and getting run over. And so with all of these, there's this really dramatic economic and social mix. So it's affordable housing. There's ample non-market housing. There's cooperatives. There's Baugruppen, urban co-housing. There's the market rate units. There's a huge array of unit sizes as well. There's studios. There's work lofts. There's flats. There's what Vienna calls smart homes, smart Wohnungen. These are really, really small, compact homes. There are homes specifically designed for single parents. There are elderly homes in the facility. There are multi-generational homes, family-sized units, cluster Wohnungen, cluster apartments. These are huge apartments, are all integrated throughout the neighborhood. And so you get this dynamic mix of that comes from that as well. There's the dynamic aspect of 20,000 jobs. This means that there are more people coming to this place for work than there are people who even live here. So there's ample space for offices, for affordable offices. There's some really wonderful buildings that are designed solely for architects, right? And so the idea, right, is that you have this place that has a very high quality of life. It's very livable. It has all of the amenities you need for the most part for daily life. It has daycare, grocery stores, cafes, markets. You know, we talk about the concept of the 15-minute city. This is almost like a 5-minute city, right? Like everything that you need can be picked up or you can go to it in under a 5-minute walk. And if you think about TOD in the US, that opportunity doesn't really exist. Another district that is underway in the city of Munich that I'm absolutely enthralled by, this is the Freiham district of Munich. When it's completed, there'll be homes for 25,000 people, just an abundant mix of social housing, market rate housing, cooperatives, student housing, multi-generational housing, senior housing, and just a whole array of innovative forms of living and dwelling. There's going to be this huge effort around affordability, multi-generational housing, family-friendly housing. This is a huge district. It's 860 acres altogether, and most of it is parks and open space, but none of it is low-rise, right? So this is going back to our missing mid-rise episode from a couple of weeks ago, right? There's no low-rise zoning here. This is effectively everything, you know, between 4 and 10 stories. On top of that, there'll be jobs for 15,000 people. There'll be affordable co-working spaces. There'll be spaces for small businesses, maker spaces, right? All of these places, there are school campuses at the edge of the district that parents and students can get to without being driven. They can walk, they can bike. There's ample bike parking along with ample bike access to the schools and at the school. The development itself is largely semi-permeable perimeter blocks. And each one of these blocks tends to have a daycare integrated directly into it. And so if you live on this block, you don't have to even cross the street to drop your kid off at daycare. You can walk, you can bike, you can roll there, and then get on with your day. And you know what's so great about this is at the end of the day, you come home, you just pick up your kid, and then you walk or bike or roll back to your home. There's not this effort of driving somewhere, picking up your kid, getting them in the car, driving in traffic back to your house, and then starting, you know, your evening and wind your day down. There'll be ample transit connections, regional and local. There's S-Bahn, which is kind of like commuter rail. There are tram. There is bike access that will connect to adjoining districts and neighborhoods and all the way to downtown Munich as well. Again, there'll be car-free spaces and streets for people to interact, engage, just be outside. There's a high focus on a good urban quality, a good spatial quality to these outdoor spaces. And so they're not auto-centric. They're not going to be inundated by noise or pollution. Like Sonnenwendviertel, there'll be cafes, there'll be restaurants, grocery stores, shops. There are a ton of parks and open space. The blocks have both private and semi-public courtyards. Most of the buildings will have private exterior space as well. And when we think about TOD, it's good to have strong concepts, right? There's a strong concept around mobility. There's strong concepts around urban structure, incorporation of nature, affordability, inclusivity. How do we develop TOD so it is a model of climate adaptive urban planning rather than a vessel for economic return? And so when we look at the framework plan for Munich's Freiham district, and this is a plan that was developed by Ordner und Ordner Baukunst, Topotech 1, West 8 for the Freiham Nord. So it's a couple of different sections. The way that they've arranged this is, it's frankly amazing. There's the car-free streets. There's a bike network. On the perimeter blocks, not all of the buildings are the same size. There's buildings of different heights. And this does a couple of things. It allows for kind of flexibility in use, diversity in types of housing. The corners are accentuated with towers, which help with wayfinding. Again, you know, think about making places that are accessible. That means, you know, for people who have issues navigating visually as well. Also integrated into the facility, cultural spaces, churches, family centers, youth centers. There are really strong concepts around different kinds of open and green space. So there's the Verkehrsfläche, that's the traffic, you know, space for cars and bikes and transit and people. There are the pedestrian zone and squares and plazas that unfold off of that. There are special green spaces. There's forest, there's parks, there's the semi-private courtyards. And so there's just this broad array of open spaces that you don't see in TOD in the US. And the urban structure of it is intended to really make them desirable places for people to live. On the periphery, there's the school campus with primary, middle, and secondary schools. There are sports fields and complexes, right? And the access to all of these is not, it's not predominantly driven by the automobile. It's very much intended to be easily accessed by foot or by bike or by public transit. And so the thing that you'll get with this is, I think, and we'll see in the next couple of years as it gets built, is a place that people want to live, that they can afford to live, that is desirable, it's affordable. It has a very kind of healthy mix in residents. It's got a good economic and social mix. It's not 95% dinks or singles. There's families, there's seniors, there's single parents, right? It's kind of accessible and open to a much broader array of people. And so when we're planning districts, how do we take these things into account? How do we get a good economic and social mix of residents? Well, if we're reserving 95% of the land for spaces for offices and spaces for market rate housing and almost no affordable housing, no opportunities for cooperatives or Baugruppen or community land trusts or other forms of non-market housing, well, we're effectively saying that this isn't a district that's meant to have a good economic and social mix. When we don't take noise into account and we situate these districts along arterials, along highways, and then do virtually nothing to alleviate the noise and the pollution that comes with those conditions, we're effectively saying we don't care about the public health of the residents who live in these developments. When we design a development and we don't have maker spaces or affordable artists' ateliers, affordable co-working spaces, and effectively just allow market rate buildings that'll be white collar, tech worker, we're really saying that the people who work here, it's not going to be a good mix of workers as well. And what are the knock-on effects of that? Well, if you only have wealthy people living in a district, then most of your cafes and shops and things of that nature are going to cater to the wealthy people so that the lower income people don't have the same opportunity and access. And going back to the issue about aesthetics, I think so many of the failings of transit-oriented development come from the building layout itself. The double-loaded corridor obviously prevents a diversity of unit sizes. It prevents climate adaptation. So going back to the aesthetics of transit-oriented transit development in the U.S. Because our codes generally require buildings to be larger and larger, it's really difficult to do small-scale buildings that touch, right? You lose that fine-grained aspect. But if you look at TOD projects in Europe, they're not all massive buildings. One of the more stunning modern developments, Neckarbogen is a new district in Heilbronn. Neckar is the Neckar River. Bogen means curve. It's kind of at the apex of the curve of the Neckar as it flows around Heilbronn. And the development of this project is really interesting. It's fairly straightforward, simple blocks with a fair amount of open space. You know, the urban character of these blocks, they're semi-permeable perimeter blocks, they're a diversity of building types and sizes. But what I think is really interesting compared to how we do development in the U.S. is most of these buildings are not very deep. They're probably on the order of 7 to 10 meters deep, and they're not very wide either. Instead of one building taking up the entire building site, you have a block that has 6, 10, 12 different buildings, and these are actually physically different buildings on the same block. And even on the same block face, you can have 3, 4, 5, 6 different buildings. So there's a fair amount of architectural diversity on this block face and in this development that is, in a lot of ways, actual diversity, right? Like, these are different buildings. It's social housing next to a Baugruppe, next to market rate housing, next to student housing. Right, so there's that good economic mix at the block level. And the way that our building codes and zoning codes are written, that diversity, that fine-grained aspect of urbanism is not legal. It's not possible. And so we have this condition in U.S. cities, especially around TOD, where the buildings effectively have to get bigger and bigger, consume half or most of the block to be financially worthwhile for the developer. We miss that fine-grained aspect, right? It's one big building. We can try to dress it up and make it look like several buildings, but we all know that that doesn't work. It ends up looking worse. And then the other aspect of the Neckarbogen project is you've got the character of the street facade, you've got the character of the courtyard facade, and they're very different characters. And then the development itself opens up to park space, to green space. There are trees. You know, part of the development is within the floodplain of the Neckar, so the urban development itself is a means of kind of mitigating the seasonal flooding that comes with that and adapting to it, right? And so you have this incredible diversity of housing types. There's a fair amount of diversity, economic and social mixing within the block itself, right? There's this character of the development that we can't do in the U.S. And so when I talk about unfucking TOD, this is exactly what I'm talking about. How do we get back to the way that cities have developed for centuries and recapture that fine-grained aspect, recapture the broad economic and social mix that cities need, really, to thrive and be livable and equitable and affordable, right? And there's this honesty that's associated with the Neckarbogen project that the U.S. TOD could never achieve. And I think that that honesty works its way through everything. It allows those districts to meet their framework, to meet their affordability requirements, to meet their climate goals, urban spaces that are of a high quality. There's a very good quality of life in the district. It's quiet, it's livable, accessible, it's family friendly, it's affordable, right? There are all of these aspects to transit-oriented development that we could be integrating into TOD here in the U.S., but it's completely thrown off the table. Everything is dictated solely by the market. There's little to no focus on all of these other aspects. And so you still need a car to get around. It's not designed as a city of short distances or a neighborhood of short distances, right? Like, it's not a 1-minute neighborhood or a 5-minute neighborhood. We're not very good at getting the good mix of uses. We're not very good at getting the good economic and social mix of residents. And until we figure out how to do that, until we figure out how to make spaces that people want to be in, that are not loud, that are approachable, that are accessible, that are affordable, we're just going to see TOD that is, it's a monoculture. And so if we start to take these things into account, right, if we take mobility, we make spaces that are car-free, community-oriented, ample open space between buildings, car-free streets, incorporate things like playgrounds and allotment gardens. So we need a good open space concepts. How are we dealing with city ecology? Where's the climate adaptation? What are we doing to protect residents from overheating? What are we doing to protect residents from noise? What are we doing to protect them from rainwater inundation events? One of the aspects that you get with these large parks in a lot of European TOD projects is blue-green infrastructure. They're retention ponds, they're sponges, you know, for that water. They provide spaces for natural cooling, fresh air. When your TOD in the U.S. is 90% building and a couple of parks surrounded by streets, you don't get that same effect, right? There's not the possibility to protect your residents from noise, to provide fresh air, to provide natural cooling that you could. And for me, part of it is also, it's ditching the double-loaded corridor. It's more point access blocks. It's more single-loaded corridors. It's a strong urban structure with bigger courtyards, functional outdoor space, car-free spaces, green middles, right? Having the Courtier Park and it's not inundated by traffic, places that the youth can hang out, that seniors can hang out, gardens, right? When we start to take all of these into effect, we create spaces that are more livable, have a higher quality of life, and I think we'll have a higher rate of return. They'll be more desirable. People will want to live here. They'll take care of it. And thinking in terms of life cycles, I think that this is an approach that creates lasting neighborhood. So many buildings in TOD projects tend to look and perform as effectively one generation buildings. They're not really intended to be around for the long haul. Again, it's a vessel for economic return. So really, it's that aspect of it. How do we design these better places? How do we plan and design these places that improve quality of life? And not just for the people who live there, but also for the people in the adjoining neighborhoods and districts. How do we improve affordability? How do we use these districts to improve our affordable housing dilemma that effectively hits almost every major city in the U.S. now? How do we use these districts? How do we plan these districts to be climate adaptive, to deal with the rain inundations, to deal with the heat dome, to deal with the droughts? We should be looking at these developments as a once-in-a-generation opportunity to seriously take livability, quality of life, climate action, climate adaptation seriously. And the only way to do that is to really, it's a massive change in the way we do planning in the U.S. But I think that the end result will be the kinds of neighborhoods that planners have talked about doing in the U.S. for decades. So once we do that, once we transit-oriented development, I think we can really start to make these places that have a high quality of life, that are affordable, that have a broad economic and social mix of residents and workers. And in doing so, directly address the urban mobility crisis, directly address our open space crises, directly address affordability and climate action. Another issue with so many TOD projects in the U.S., they're basically projects that have a very short life cycle. They're not flexible buildings. They're not buildings that can be easily converted into other uses. They're not future-proof. There are almost no architects in the U.S. who are taking flexibility into account. The way we design buildings, the double-loaded corridor, it's very strict design. There's not a lot of flexibility. It's difficult to come back in and retrofit apartments or other uses. You know, these aren't climate-adaptive buildings as well. And so in thinking about how we're designing these neighborhoods, right? What are we doing to make them future-proof? What are we doing to make them flexible, habitable, climate-adaptive, livable, affordable, right? All of these things that we could really be squeezing into these wondrous developments, these transit-oriented neighborhoods. It's so frustrating watching what goes on in Europe, watching what goes on in Japan or other countries around transit. We do everything wrong. And it's incredibly frustrating that we don't take this opportunity to really optimize or maximize, you know, these neighborhoods to be, you know, these wondrous places, these places where people can get by without having to drive everywhere. And thinking about how we are planning cities or neighborhoods around issues around climate adaptation, walkability, the 15-minute city, you know, inherent in all of this is that our buildings need to be flexible. One of the conversations that's occurring right now with work from home and the pandemic is, how do we convert offices in downtown cities in the U.S. to be more family friendly or more residential in nature? Well, the problem is we never really had limits on depth. We didn't have daylight kind of dictating the depths of our buildings. And so our floor plates tend to be significantly thicker than you would find in a place like Germany or in a place like Austria or Switzerland. And so in a country like that, where you don't have a thick floor plate, it's relatively easy to go back in and retrofit those buildings to accommodate residential or to accommodate even a mix of uses. When you have deep floor plates and when you don't have, you know, smart planning around flexibility and issues around daylight and, you know, how to future-proof a building, we leave a lot on the table, right? We prevent allowing the kinds of future-proof neighborhoods that we could be seeing, and frankly, that they're starting to build more and more of in European cities. So I don't know if this is the exact way to TOD, but I know that if we really care about livability, if we really care about quality of life, about affordability, about accessibility, about climate adaptation, we significantly and drastically have to change the way we are designing cities. We have to significantly and drastically fix the way that we're doing transit-oriented development and move towards something that's more flexible, more open, more affordable, and all of these things. So if we do that, I'd like to think that we could unfuck TOD. If not, then we'll get buildings that are at least climate adaptive, livable, more affordable, in districts that have a better economic and social mix of people, a good mix of uses, is highly walkable with sustainable buildings, flexible buildings. You know, it's sustainable, it's future-proof, it's hitting all of those things. I guess it could be worse, but we have a lot of work to do. If you're interested in continuing this conversation online, offline, please get in contact with us at Larch Lab. We would love to keep this conversation going. Have a good weekend, everybody. Ciao. Thanks to our listeners for joining us on the Livable Low Carbon City podcast. We'll be back with another episode soon to broaden the discourse and highlight how we can co-create a low-carbon urban future together. If you'd like to know more about what Larch Lab is doing, please subscribe to our monthly newsletter. I'll add the link to the episode notes.